From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. A recent United Nations report concluded that 40 million Americans are poor, and of those, 18.5 million live in extreme poverty. The Trump administration angrily denounced those findings, with UN Ambassador Nikki Haley saying it is, quote, patently ridiculous for the UN to examine poverty in America. The administration decided that only 250,000 Americans live in extreme poverty. But unsurprisingly, the Trump administration is, of course, lying, and the UN is correct. Poverty is a huge issue in America, and in California, the richest state in the nation, we see the highest rates of poverty. Right-wing politicians blame the state's more generous social safety net, but a new book details how it may be a lack of political power among low-income communities that most greatly hinders their ability to beat back poverty. My guest is Suzanne Bowen, an award-winning reporter. She spent 12 years working for the Bay Area News Group, which includes the San Jose Mercury News, the Contra Costa Times, and Oakland Tribune. She won the 2010 White House Correspondent Association Award for her reporting on health disparities. She joins me to discuss her new book. It's called 20 Years of Life, Why the Poor Die Earlier and How to Challenge Inequity. Welcome to the program, Suzanne.
Thank you, Sonalia. Glad to be here.
So before we get to this more important second part of your subtitled, How to Challenge Inequity, and your coverage of this very fascinating, innovative campaign, let's talk about the grim figures and statistics. I mentioned California, richest state in the nation, highest levels of poverty. What are some of the numbers for us to be able to understand how dire poverty is in California?
Well, you've put out the numbers quite well, and you know, we do have one of the highest rates of child poverty, and you know, the life expectancy gap is really what I concentrate on. And in California, in one community, for example, there's a 16-year life expectancy gap, and it's about 8 miles as the crow flies. But this is true all over the nation. This is not unique to California, of course. Baltimore has some of the lowest life expectancy, and you contrast that with the wealthier communities outside of Baltimore, and that there you're looking at 20 years of life expectancy difference. Native American reservations are often into the 60s. It can even exceed a 20-year gap between neighboring communities. So this astonishing chasm in life expectancy and disease burden throughout one's life is prevalent throughout the nation and linked to poverty and lack of political empowerment, as the case I make in my book.
So let's get right to the heart of the issue. You have been covering for years now a very long-term campaign by the California Endowment that basically decided that the old ways of tackling poverty were simply not working. Tell us what the California Endowment decided to do in the state of California, and why it's different from sort of other nonprofit, non-governmental approaches.
It's radically different, and they really put themselves out on a limb to pursue this, and I do, you know, give them great credit for taking this risk, as I outline in the book. California Endowment is the largest health foundation in California, one of the largest health foundations in the nation. They have about $4 billion in assets. They came from, as I describe, a conversion foundation, but that's a detail. But what they did is they decided to invest in changing neighborhood conditions rather than focus on delivering programs and services that can disappear when the funding dries up. And that's been the model that philanthropy has followed for decades and really hasn't moved the needle at all on these rates of poverty and distress in these communities. What the California Endowment recognized, and others have recognized this, but the California Endowment decided to really invest in challenging the situation, was that there was a lack of political power in these low-income communities. It was leading to this chronic state of distress where really it's almost like third world conditions in many of these communities. High crime rates, lack of access to healthy food, you know, just basic resources are missing,
and so
no safe places to play.
So when you say lack of political power, it's sort of, I'm wondering if you, if we can put it in the opposite terms. For example, when you have a project for a highway to cut through a wealthy community, or, you know, any kind of, say there's a wealthy community that is upset with the closure of a critical, I don't know, health food store, those folks have the resources, the time, the ability, the money to organize, to stop bad things from happening in their community and to attract good things in their community. That's what helps in the long term those communities thrive. Is that one way to examine how the opposite is true? And so, of course, in poor communities where there are no, where there aren't those resources and time and ability and political power, you end up having these conditions that foster poverty.
That's right. That's a great comparison, because we all know that in wealthier communities, if there's a threat to that community, say somebody proposes opening some kind of a, you know, factory, or, you know, allowing diesel trucks to go through their community, they will all rally to oppose that and oftentimes succeed. But the problem has been in these poorer communities that there's a lack of social cohesion between the people. There's often a lack of trust among those living there. They are very busy. They're often working two or three jobs, and they also don't feel heard. They don't feel that their voices matter, because they've been constantly told that they're not important. And so what the endowment has done is put their resources into helping these communities get organized by giving them the tools. They hold, just on a practical basis, like they'll have the community identify, have a listening campaign, help the community identify what are your top priorities for change. And once they identify that, be it school discipline reform, be it healthier food, be it a new park, be it more safety on the streets, then the endowment helps them come together to petition their local authorities to make changes, or local elected officials. And they do that by sponsoring community meetings at night that have, you know, food there and childcare, so people can take off after a long day of work and attend these evening meetings. That it's just not practical for many of these people when they have kids to feed at home, or a 5-year-old child that needs care. So they make it practical, and they also, here's a critical part of this campaign, they take the, all the nonprofits working in these communities, or a big substantial portion of them, they work together. They're all given grants under a common cause, and all having agreeing to a common outcome. And it's called collective impact. So that nonprofit groups, I've heard it again and again in these 14 communities that are part of this 10-year, $1 billion campaign, although it is extending beyond its original 2020 expiration. But these people have told me, the nonprofit leaders saying, I never used to talk to so-and-so, and head of another nonprofit, and now they're collaborating and working together. And it's really making enormous difference in these communities to have the nonprofit organizations, as well as some of the service agencies like, you know, Health and Human Services, police department, and so on, all working collectively.
So does this model sort of upend that traditional dynamic between service providers or nonprofit organizations, charities, et cetera, and communities, where the old model is you, as a nonprofit, step back and try to identify what a community needs and give it to that community, and then wonder why it may not work in the long term? Instead, you work, this model works with the community and empowers them to lead the change?
That's right. And what I really hope in this book, and why I really detail what the California Endowment has done, is to provide a blueprint for others in philanthropy that this is a highly effective way of producing lasting change, and to shift off this system that's easy to do, where you open up, you know, a food pantry or a clinic or exercise classes or something, but you're not really creating fundamental change. And you can, yeah, as a nonprofit or a philanthropy, you can go to your board of directors and say, well, we had 300 people come out for our exercise class, but how many people, how has that really led to systematic long-term change in the community? And what they are focusing on in the California Endowment is how many policy wins and systems changes result from this. And that's sustainable. That lasts through the generations. And they have 530 plus today. There's actually more since the book went to press. But these are laws that are passed at the state level, at the local level. These are new ways of funding in the new systems changes in terms of how funding is flowing into these communities and policy changes that help improve conditions in these communities.
So these are laws and policies that were passed by the efforts of empowered citizens because of the support that they've gotten from this nonprofit effort, from I believe it's called Healthy Communities campaign, right?
Right, the Building Healthy Communities campaign. I'll give you a couple of examples. One of their first major success was the school discipline reform campaign, where when they started this California Endowment started the Building Healthy Communities campaign in 2010. They had no idea that school discipline, excessive school disciplines that were kicking kids out of school and onto the streets and creating what's called the school to prison pipeline. Because once you're out on the street, you start interacting with law enforcement, you get labeled as a bad kid, and so on and so forth.
And meanwhile, just a quick interruption, the whole conversation around gun violence in schools has ignored the fact that, at least in California, at least schools are over-policed, and that young children of color are the ones who, and poor kids are the ones who pay the highest price for the over-policing. And you see these conversations around, well, all we need is more armed police, guards, etc. at schools. And of course, the primary targets aren't mass shooters, they're kids themselves.
That's right. And just as an aside, the school discipline reform is a remarkable state level success, and I'll give a 30-second background on that. But one, just to your point there about police officers on campus, one organizing campaign led by kids under this program caused them to protest to the school district about armed police officers. They wanted some presence, so they asked for them to be out of uniform. So the kids negotiated and won officers on campus, but not in uniform. So that's what made it was a compromise. But back to the with the school discipline, real quickly, I describe it in two chapters, changing schools rules and keeping kids in school. But it led to they realized that disproportionately black and brown kids were getting kicked out. And they, as a result, with intense community organizing and up to the state level, because this campaign also concentrates on not just changing conditions and building political power and cohesion in the 14 communities that are part of this, but they have a statewide team of politically savvy experts who, once they identify something in these 14 communities that seems to have statewide import, then they take it up to the legislative chambers and work on getting laws passed. And to date, now there are 11 new school discipline reform policies directly attributed to this Building Healthy Communities work. It's spelled out. It's nobody debates that. And it's led to a more than 300,000 student reduction in suspensions every year in California since this campaign started. And there's now an 8% increase in high school graduation. Now, some people could argue there's other factors, but it's very clear that this school discipline reform, which prohibits throwing kids off school for, willful defiance, it puts limits on that and so on. And it calls for restorative justice. It's leading to more restorative justice efforts on campus, where kids who are troubled acting out can get the support on campus from adults and caring and supportive adults to lead them back into a better path. And the results have been just astounding. One really moving story after another that I've come across.
Now, the so what is quite remarkable about this campaign, there's two issues. One is that it's evidence-based, right? It's actually been proven to work strikingly well. And two, that it's long-term. Is there a plan, as you said, that's going to be expanded and extended? But Is this the kind of model that we could see across the nation that would enable long-term systemic change to the point where we would not need nonprofit help for communities? I mean, I guess what I'm trying to say is that we seem to be trapped in a cycle. Americans seem to be trapped in a cycle of poverty where Band-Aid solutions are being proposed. But of course, when we have systemic change, you don't need the Band-Aids when communities heal.
Correct. Yeah, nobody wants to look at the real issue of power. There's a power imbalance. Yeah. And this is about getting representatives from the poor communities a seat at the table. Because, as I say, politics is all about a fight for the allocation of scarce resources. And these communities have never even had a seat at the table. So it's getting them a seat at the table. What I really think it's about is philanthropy changing its focus to concentrate on building up power. They're doing it slowly. I think they're really sort of dipping their toes into it. There's some, concern about it. It's a new way of approaching this, although more and more philanthropies are. But the endowment just went full bore into this and also committed to 10 years, which is quite outstanding. Because a lot of philanthropies, if they don't quite get the results they want after a few years, they'll pull out. And some of these communities, it took quite a few years to begin to see results, as you can imagine, building up political power, building up cohesion, getting people involved, pressing city councils and county boards of supervisors and planning commissions to change policies and enact new laws takes time. But once they hung on by year five, when I first started reporting on this, it was 2 years into it. By year five, six, it was astounding the progress they were starting to make. So the 10-year commitment is huge. And because it's working so well, they're going to extend it and continue this.
It seems as though one of the, well, let me ask you this. Here's an issue. The main issue of poverty, or one of the main ways to address poverty, is to simply require higher wages, right? And we've seen these campaigns around the country for $15 an hour. And of course, even that's not really enough. It takes a political will, even at the government level, to change minimum wage laws. How does empowering communities from the bottom up to push for change come into conflict with government? I mean, this model that you described allows different nonprofits to collaborate with one another, with communities, but also with government agencies. Is there a limit to that when the government itself may step in and say that's too much political power and we can't, acquiesce to this demand for change?
Well, yeah, it's interesting you mentioned that, because there have been protests by local electeds to this campaign working in their community, saying you're arousing too much trouble in our community,
right,
and tap down. So endowment leadership got more than one phone call from local, county supervisors or city council people saying back down. You're out of line as a foundation to be doing this, but they just proceeded. They said, no, this is about building health, because ultimately these gaps in life expectancy are really due to the toll of chronic stress and resource deprivation, fear of crime. And so when you empower people to demand that their communities have the same kinds of basic resources that wealthier middle class areas do, safe parks, healthy places, places to buy healthy food, decent schools, then you are going to see significant improvements in health.
So, and this is so interesting that also the framing of this approach seems to be such an important one. Nonprofits are expected to stay out of politics, right? We're often told that the groups that have 501c3 status are often told that you can't get into politics. It's beyond the scope of your work. Of course, the actual rules are quite narrow, so you can get very political while staying out of electoral politics and backing candidates and races, etc. But it seems as though the California Endowment, in framing the conversation around public health, has been able to sidestep some of these accusations, or at least, have a stronger justification.
Correct. And what they concentrate on is education. The activism is done by these community groups. So they cannot lobby, but they can educate, and they can, you know, advocate. So they toe that line very carefully. They're very, very conscious of that. But I think that's why perhaps this is my assessment, that other philanthropies are a little more careful to stay away from that line, and thus they're not engaging in power building. And yet this is where the real change lies, and where the real lasting change, that's the key, lasting, sustainable change. And you're also changing cultures. And what's also been incredible in these communities is the inspiring stories, how people get so excited when they have a success. I've talked to, you know, women, older women, who finally got the city council. They were part of an advocacy, and the city council actually passed a law that they advocated for, and they can't believe it, that they actually had a voice and were able to pass a law. I have a story in there about 50 youth in City Heights organized, and with the aid of, you know, polling data, research data, advertising funding, they were able to convince the city council, after attending some 100 meetings in various city agencies, to get two skate parks worth about $6 million into these communities. And these kids are transformed by that experience. I interview some of them in the book, and their careers are now focused on working in social services and politics.
So they were given a taste of the success that you can enjoy when you actually exercise the political power, the civic privileges that we have of living in a democracy, which is, as you said, a lesson that they can carry on through their lifetime. We could be seeding hundreds or countless numbers of community organizers for life.
Exactly. Mm. And there's something like 1,500 youth trained in this, and they're very excited, and they feel like they can take on the world and make a difference. And what it shows, it's very exciting to me, because we live in challenging times, as we all know, but civic power is alive and well. We just have to exercise it. And actually, the endowment also funded what they called the VOTA campaign, which was all about education, encouraging people to come out and vote, regardless of, there was no party, focus. But what the Secretary of State of California credited that with higher voter engagement in 2016. And actually, Daniel Zingali, who heads up the state team for the California Endowment, he's a former advisor to Schwarzenegger and Gray Davis and so on. He said that, you know, it actually allowed California to have a fairly progressive agenda passed in 2016, despite what happened nationwide.
Well, I want to thank you so much, Suzanne, for joining us today and for sharing the stories from this book about this remarkable campaign. Are there any websites you can recommend for people to find out more, particularly those living outside California who are interested in seeing the model that the California Endowment has launched and wanting to mimic that in their own communities?
Yes. Yes, absolutely. CalEndow, CalEndow.org is the website for California Endowment. Also, of course, you know, my book, of course, describes it in detail in a way that brings it all together and offers the 10,000-foot perspective, as well as some real close-ups. And that's under my name on Amazon, or 20 Years of Life.
And people can certainly pick up a copy from their independent bookstore. Very well worth reading,
absolutely.
Suzanne, thank you so much for joining us. Good luck to you.
Thank you, Sonali. Great to talk to you.
Suzanne Bowen is an award-winning reporter, having spent 12 years working for the Bay Area News Group, which includes the San Jose Mercury News, Contra Costa Times, and Oakland Tribune. She won the White House Correspondents Association Award for her reporting on health disparities. We've just been discussing her new book. It's called 20 Years of Life, Why the Poor Die Earlier and How to Challenge Inequity. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Vimeo.